So nice to have you back, Tony, on this podcast. And let's get started with what's going on right now in the Middle East. The tensions are growing between Iran and Israel. And we had an Iranian attack on Israel. In the media in the United Kingdom, specifically Sky News, they're talking about that most of those missiles were failed and they couldn't reach the target. And but after all, how did you find this new escalation between Iran and Israel?
The Iranian response has been delayed quite a bit. And a couple of days ago, the Iranian president, kind of the new president, basically admitted that they'd delayed any response to the earlier outrages with killing Haniyeh in Tehran, and also the an attack on Beirut that killed an IRGC member, and of course Nasrallah as well. So basically he said that they were told, or the Iranians were told by the US and the Europeans, that, you know, don't do anything in retaliation because, honest, there's a ceasefire coming in Gaza. So they held off. That seems plausible, actually, but it shows a certain degree of naivety on the part of the new president if he did that. And what had happened in more recent days was that there were big demonstrations in Tehran and in other places around Iran, really protesting the fact there'd been no action taken to do anything in retaliation. So this blast of missiles that they did, there's a couple of interesting features there. Firstly, back in April, when they did the first retaliation, they used very many drones, which were, you know, pretty slow speed and could easily be hit by the air defense systems. And what that did was it gave them a good amount of information about where the air defense systems were and the kind of response they could expect. And what happened back in April was they gave quite a bit of notice to the US ahead of time, so they could put all the forces in place to try and knock out the missiles and drones before they got to Israel, basically. This time round, there does seem to have been some advance warning, but only maybe of a matter of hours. It was a couple of hours or so before the missiles kind of were in the airspace above Israel and actually landed, that the US made some statement. So they probably were kind of given some warning, although it could have been that the US just found, you know, some intel that this was going to happen anyway. But they didn't really have that much time to prepare as compared to last time. And what happened was, I don't think there are any drones used, not by Iran anyway. And instead, reports of something like 180 ballistic missiles, including hypersonic missiles. And the story that, oh, they're all knocked out, you know, taken out by the air defense systems, is just rubbish, basically. No doubt some of them were. That's always the case. There's a proportion that get hit. The Iranians say 90% got through. You know, maybe it was less than that, who knows. But a fair number did get through. And, you know, some may have missed a bit. That's true. But basically, it looks like several air bases were taken out or like hit and damaged quite considerably. And these air bases were ones that were used by the Israelis to get American weapons in over, you know, over the past year, and which have been used to bomb Gaza and actually also bomb bomb Lebanon for that matter. So they did quite a bit of damage like that, but it's still a relatively restrained response, actually, you have to say that. And certainly they haven't followed the classic Israeli line of killing as many people as possible. It looks like there was only a few casualties among civilians, and some of them were caused by air defense missiles bringing down something, and the shrapnel or whatever caused problems on the ground. So they've done actually a pretty clinical attack on Israel. But of course, it's all dressed up in the Western media as being some outrageous attack. Where did this come from? You know, there've been some funny comments. Well, you know, Israel was peacefully just genociding a couple of million people. You know, what's unreasonable about that? Why was there such a terrible response? And in addition, it looks like, although, you know, I haven't really seen confirmation of this, because in general, confirmation is not easy to get, because the Israelis are censoring quite a lot of the information. But it looks like also they attacked a gas station just off the coast, and you know that's something which could you know, the gas station wouldn't have been, when I say gas, I mean actual natural gas coming out of the ground, basically, or under the sea, not gas as in gasoline. They basically have therefore hit a number of areas of Israel which hasn't been done for a very long time, apart from back in April. That anything substantial has really got hit. It looks like there was a near miss on a Mossad headquarters in Tel Aviv as well. There's a huge crater just down the road. Not sure why that was a miss. You know, it could have even been on purpose. But it really showcased the abilities of Iran to do this. And they could easily do a great deal more. The interesting thing is that the air defenses actually don't seem to work very well at all. There are several layers of air defenses that Israel has. And basically, even if they were, you know, the best in the universe and, you know, very excellent, the problem you have is that if you fire, you know, 180 missiles or 200 missiles at the same time, even the perfect system can't get everything. And their system is far from perfect anyway. They have several elements, mostly focused on the kinds of missiles they've been getting from Gaza and other places. And they have some for ballistic missiles. And also the Patriot system of the US is in Israel as well. But it looks like the Iranians also used hypersonic missiles, and basically those systems can't touch them. And some of the videos, again, it's not entirely confirmed, but some of the videos indicate a really very, very fast incursion of the missile. So, you know, that's it. What this has done, it's a major blow to Israel, although because they have such an influence over the Western media, all of the focus instead has been on the outrageous act by, unprovoked, of course, by Iran on Israel. But what it's done is really strike a serious blow to their military impunity that they've had, because they're blasting away at Gaza and also more recently Lebanon. They've had more or less a free hand, because Lebanon doesn't really have any air defenses. And so they've done all this, and this kind of sense of impunity has given them even more outrageous kind of scope to go and kill anybody they like, basically. But it's actually a serious blow to Israel, and something which they've promised they'll respond to. But so far, I've only seen news of them again attacking Lebanon and maybe one or two other places. I don't see anything in the direction of Iran yet in the news. It's early days, you know, 3 o'clock or so on a Friday afternoon, my time. So, you know, who knows in the next couple of days. And this is a fast developing situation. But it seems to have not really stopped the Israeli invasion of Lebanon. And the killing in Gaza still goes on. So, although this is important and an important blow against the Israeli kind of psyche and the Israeli military, it hasn't really stopped them from doing what they were doing already. And what has happened in Lebanon, again, they've had a free hand pretty much because of the lack of air defenses. But what's happened as they've tried to move ground forces in, they've suffered quite a bit. And there are lots of counterattacks by Hezbollah in the south, which are causing them quite a few problems. Again, all of this is kind of hushed up, and it's difficult to get the up-to-date information, but that's what was coming out this morning from a whole number of different sources.
The latest news that Sky News was talking with the Israelis, it seems that in this attack, in this offensive, in the southern part of Lebanon, they have lost 14 soldiers so far, and they're retreating from their positions in the southern part of Lebanon. But and the question is, Tony, that you see what has happened to Gaza, the assassination of the leaders of Hamas, the assassination of Nasrallah, right now this invasion of Lebanon. The question is, what would be the limit for the Israelis' actions, the way that they're behaving right now, and what would the international community do in order to avoid this type of behavior on their part? It doesn't seem we have any sort of reaction from the international community. I'm talking about the Western countries, the NATO countries. Then it seems that the only thing that they're having right now is Iranian response, because Iran can do nothing about in terms of international community. Russia, Iran, China, they're trying to talk with them, but nobody seems to understand what they're talking about.
Yeah, well, part of the problem is this term international community. There isn't one, basically. You know, it in principle, it's under the heading of the United Nations, but already the Israelis have declared persona non grata, you know, the Secretary General of the United Nations. So, you know, I mean, maybe the US and Israel should set up their own United Nations. You know, they seem to be pretty united already. So the thing is that in a way, you have to step back a bit, because the situation is that Israel has been used as a tool by the US, and previously, and it still is part of a tool of the other Western powers in the region. And the whole issue was to, you know, prevent any growth of Arab nationalism in particular, and just generally clamp down on any signs of serious dissidents. And so that's been its key role, and it's expanded its role in other respects, you know, over the decades, including in Africa and Latin America. as well as in Central Asia. It's done a whole bunch of different things, dirty jobs that the US doesn't want to do directly. So really with that role, and it seemed to have that role implicitly by most of or all of the Western powers, I would say. So you have complete backing from the UK, complete backing from the EU, and even one of the EU dissidents, Orbán of Hungary, has recently came out, and or I think earlier today or late yesterday, indicating worries about the civilians in Israel. You know, well, what about the civilians in Gaza and Lebanon? So they basically, by having this role, any breaking of so-called humanitarian rules gets ignored, basically. And, you know, the only good side about this is that the huge hypocrisy that you see every single day when you find US politicians standing up and talking about it, or the spokesman of the White House, or, you know, National Security Advisor, all these people, it's just so blatantly a pack of, you know, double standards, lies and everything else, that that does open people's eyes a bit more to what's really going on. But the problem is that the Western powers would do nothing because Israel plays this role for them. And they haven't really found an alternative. If you look at the region, I was just looking at just the issue of, say, populations, that Iran is the only big country population-wise and having good development in the region. And it's the only one really which has tried to gain some independence, basically. You know, and obviously since the Iranian Revolution, there's been the, you know, conflict with the US and sanctions and everything else. And if any other country tried to do business with Iran, like Europeans did for a while, they then get drawn into the US sanctions, you know, directly or indirectly. So the Europeans stopped doing much business with Iran, and more or less none. You know, so Iran is now this terrorist country and all the rest of it. The other countries have basically been colonized by the US or completely under the US thumb. So Egypt has done nothing about Gaza. And basically, you know, the government in Egypt is more or less installed by the US and everything in the past decade. Then if you take Iraq, well, Iraq still got US forces in it, and they don't want them there, but the US won't leave. Saudi Arabia, again, US bases, trying to hedge its bets with BRICS, and that's why it hasn't properly come out and said, yes, we're a member of BRICS. You know, so they're still kind of in the halfway house there. They come along to the meetings, but they haven't made an official announcement that they're there. And all of the regional countries, apart from Yemen, have, you know, either tried to stay in the middle somewhere or haven't done anything about what's going on in Palestine. And I think it points up where countries stand, and not simply in the region, actually, but all throughout the West and everywhere else. Where you stand on the question of Palestine is a really strong indication of your attitude, opinions regarding Western imperialism. And, you know, you find even on the part of the Russians and the Chinese, they don't do much about it. They've made, actually, I welcome this over the past 6 months or so, or the past 9 months to a year, they've made more statements that they're against what's going on and the genocide in Gaza, but hasn't really amounted to that much. And only stronger statements in the past couple of months, you know, what they've done. But, you know, as I say, there is no international community, so-called, and none of these things have any force. And it's only really been action from, you know, Yemen, from within Gaza itself, and Hezbollah, and other parts of the resistance axis in Iraq, a little bit in Syria too, that have tried to put a stop to this. And it's difficult to see it stopping. And I think the only thing that will stop it, at least, to a great degree, is a serious military defeat of Israel. That's what has to happen. And we haven't seen it yet, unfortunately. So this is still going on.
Yeah. Do you think that this invasion of Lebanon can bring that type of defeat that you're talking about?
I think it will contribute quite a bit to it, because it will, in addition to what should be an embarrassment for them, you know, the Iranian missiles, that they can cover that up to some extent by just editing the news and pretending it didn't happen, or saying we will respond. But the invasion of Lebanon, well, the thing is that Hezbollah will definitely fight back drastically, and they don't mind dying to fight back in doing this, you know. So I think there's a strong chance that Hezbollah will be able to push them back, and that will be a big problem for them, because the arrogance and excessive belief they can get away with anything made the Israelis recently even start claiming that they will have this huge buffer zone in southern Lebanon. They'll push them back to beyond the Litani River. And, you know, essentially it would be another part of the Greater Israel plan, you know. And it wasn't particularly the usual Greater Israel plan that included all of Palestine, which didn't include going into southern Lebanon. So, you know, they're land grabbing momentum has, you know, started including southern Lebanon now. So that, I think, will be stopped, but, you know, it's going to take a while. The thing which is happening at a slower pace, but is probably beginning to have an effect, is the impact on the Israeli economy. And you've now had two credit rating agencies that downgraded the Israeli debt. The Standard & Poor's one just yesterday or today only knocked it down to one notch from A+ to A. You know, big deal. The Moody's one a couple of days back was to a lower level, and it's just four levels now above the junk level. And a lot of the economic data on Israel are, you know, edited, hidden, whatever. But I was looking at the impact on their economy from international trade. And there are data on the volume of exports and imports into the five Israeli ports. Haifa, which is further to the north, Ashdod, which is not that far from Gaza, and Eilat are the top three. Haifa and Ashdod are the top two, and Eilat, which was greatly impacted by the Yemen attacks on the Red Sea. So Eilat was basically closed down. There's no business going through there. Nothing since February, right? Not a single ton of imports, exports. And I looked at some figures there, and all they've got in the harbour is one yacht, basically, probably just resting, you know. But the overall volume of trade, Israeli export volumes in terms of tonnage, it's not a value indicator, in terms of tonnage, has dropped 47% in the past month compared to last year. And the volume of imports has also dropped about 18%. So that's the whole, basically in the month of September compared to the previous September. So it has had quite a big impact for this to happen. And I think the drop in exports probably also indicates that there's a certain amount of boycotting of Israeli goods going on. You know, there's a fairly wide movement for boycott, divestment and everything. So I think that's beginning to have an effect. The problem is that they can have an economic squeeze, you know, and it can get worse. It will start causing domestic problems from Netanyahu, but it doesn't necessarily tip them over the edge, because they can always get more money from the US, for example. You know, even if the credit rating went to junk, the US money would still come in, basically. So, you know, that this other stuff is more of a slow burner, which undermines the Israelis. But it doesn't immediately do anything to stop them continuing their murderous rampages.
The question is, who needs more the other side? Right now, who does need Israel, and who, in terms of Israel needs, how do you find it right now? Do you think that Israel needs the Muslim countries, including Turkey, Azerbaijan, all these Arab countries, or they need Israel more than that? And how, because at the end of the day, the economy would be that important issue that you have to consider it.
Yeah.
And for the future of the country, because the people who are living in Israel, they're not talking in terms of what's going on in Gaza, they're totally in line with Netanyahu and his administration.
Oh, yeah.
What's going on right now and how that could influence their economy would be a major issue for them.
Almost you could kind of predict this in a way, but the share of Israel's trading with regional countries is actually pretty low. And a great deal of it is with the US and Europe. So, you know, so in a way already the pro-genocide, pro-Zionist kind of Western world is already doing all this trade with them. There's some trades which in some areas on figures of a couple of years ago was probably significant. Some trade with, say, Russia and China, but I think that's probably diminished now as well.
And we have the energy coming from Azerbaijan through Turkey.
Yeah. And the energy from Azerbaijan is, it's difficult to say how important it is, but it's obviously an important factor. And that goes through Turkey. Turkey recently has been saying more kind of upfront things about what's happening is dreadful. And, you know, they even called on the UN to do something militarily to stop the genocide. But, you know, I looked at some port data just a week ago, and there was a Turkish cargo ship sitting in Haifa port, you know. So despite all the rhetoric from Erdogan about no trade, it hasn't happened, right? Maybe it's less, I don't know, less compared to 6 months, a year ago, but it's still happening. And there are other reports about, you know, even if some direct shipping from Turkish ports to Israeli ports didn't happen, well, they stopped off somewhere else first to make it look like it was coming from, say, Greece rather than from Turkey, that kind of thing. So the economic stuff is a slow burner. That's the problem. It will have an impact, and it already has done. You know, the figures on migration or people exiting, because many Israelis have two passports, basically. So quite a lot of them have gone back to Europe or gone back to the US. And figures from the only figures I've seen are from a few months ago, and that was 500,000. But that's 5% of the population. So it's, you know, quite a bit in a relatively short space of time. Now, with, you know, life not being so easy, and you can't as easily just sit back and enjoy the genocide in Gaza with nothing really happening much beyond it. So now it's going to be a bit more difficult for them to ignore what's happening. So, you know, but again, the economic stuff is a slow burner. It has an effect, and it will cause kind of political problems for Netanyahu. Although, as you mentioned, you know, a very big proportion of the population supports the genocide policies, even if they don't like Netanyahu too much. So, you know, it's a much bigger problem. And that's why really it can't be solved as long as there's an Israeli state. You know, that sounds like a drastic thing to say, but all of the evidence points in that direction. So as long as there's this, you know, I wouldn't call it apartheid, because under apartheid in South Africa, they exploited the blacks but didn't kill them all and didn't expel them. You know, they put them in reservations and this sort of thing. But Israel wants to get rid of them completely, you know, send the West Bank into Jordan, send the Gaza into, you know, the desert on the border with Egypt, and, you know, just get rid of all the Palestinians. That's the underlying logic, really. So, as I say, I wouldn't call it apartheid. It's much worse. And until the state that backs this apartheid, which is the Israeli state, is destroyed, basically, gotten rid of in whatever way, then this momentum is going to continue. And the only thing that will stop it in the short term is a military defeat. And, you know, I think there'll be bits of that, but I don't know how far it's going to go. And with the US now looking as if, you know, I mean, they're not going to change their minds on it that much. And if anything, the US has shifted its focus away from Ukraine, and they're getting more worried about the Middle East. And, you know, China's always in the background as well. But there's no sign, obviously, from the two candidates for president. They're both uber Zionists anyway. So there's going to be no policy change in that respect from the US.
If Netanyahu loses the conflict in Lebanon, what would happen, in your opinion, to him in Israel?
Probably nothing, actually. You know, he'll find some way to go and spend some stash money, you know. It'd be an embarrassment. And, you know, he has legal criminal cases against him that he's managed to stop. You know, I'm not sure whether they'll be revived, that sort of thing. There'll be a lot of anger. There'll be a lot of lashing out because, you know, if you're a supremacist and you've lost or you become embarrassed, that's a big problem. Because the role that they've had all the time, anyone opposes them in terms of, you know, fighting back, you know, with weapons, then they make sure there's at least a 10-to-1 ratio of casualties. That's what they've always done for decades in Palestine. You know, and figures I might have mentioned in an earlier discussion. You know, if you take the 10 years or so before October the 7th, there was easily a 10 to 1 ratio in people killed, you know, Israelis versus, sorry, you know, 10 Palestinians per one Israeli. And the figures for casualties, as opposed to being killed, was even more than that, a far bigger proportion. And you find that reflected in the Israeli influence in the media. So as soon as someone says anything against Israel, they're immediately, you know, called an anti-Semite, and, you know, find on the social media their posts or their YouTube comments or whatever are, you know, banned or all this kind of stuff, you know. So there's everything from actual killing to outrageous slander goes on to prevent any kind of discussion of the truth regarding what's really going on. So it then means that in more recent weeks, they've gone more crazy because they can see the thing slipping away. And it is because, you know, there's a lot of world opinion has evidently turned against them. Discussions about two-state solution again and recognizing Palestine, all of that has picked up in different European countries. And, you know, and that they're getting hit on many sides, and it's a real blow to the previous kind of feeling of impunity and supremacy that they've had. So it, you know, unfortunately, it's going to be a pretty bloody outcome to this, I think. I don't think there's a peaceful way of resolving it.
When it comes to the conflict in Ukraine, where are we headed, in your opinion, with the recent visit of Zelensky to the United States? He talked with Joe Biden, with Donald Trump, and two different opinions on both sides. And we can assume that Kamala Harris gonna pursue the same line of rhetoric as Joe Biden does right now. And on the other hand, Donald Trump is totally against the conflict in Ukraine. But on the other hand, we are having the European Union, Olaf Scholz wants to talk with Putin, and the Zelensky administration doesn't seem to be in a good position. But how do you find it right now in Ukraine?
Mm-hmm. I think it has to be resolved militarily, basically, because, you know, it's a waste of time talking to the West, and Russia has finally realized this, you know, given all the deceptions around the Minsk agreements before 2022. And there's been a pretty steady progress made by the Russians on the fronts inside Ukraine itself. It's been very slow, much slower than one would have expected, partly because Russia didn't do this, you know, smash the place up completely approach that NATO did. And also they, you know, considered Ukrainians to be a brotherly country beforehand, you know, fellow Slavs, you know, many of them spoke Russian, all this kind of stuff. So it was a far slower kind of process. I think it's speeding up now. And more kind of land and positions are taken on the front lines. What surprised me a bit, and we discussed this a little bit, I think, last time, was that the invasion of the Kursk region by Ukrainian forces, well, that certainly surprised Russia, I think. I don't really go along with the interpretations that it was somehow a trap set by Russia to let them in, and then you can destroy lots of NATO equipment and, you know, destroy lots of elite forces or all this kind of thing. I don't really go along with that. By diverting troops into the Kursk region, they've certainly weakened the front lines elsewhere. And they've lost a huge amount of material as well, you know, tanks, the electronic warfare facilities, air defense, etc., etc. So, and based on the latest figures from the Russian Ministry of Defense, show something like 20,000 casualties the Ukrainians have suffered in Kursk alone. And the figures for Ukraine on the front lines within Ukraine on a daily basis are more than 2,000. You know, anything from, you know, maybe 1,900-ish up to 2,500 every single day, basically. So it's definitely wearing down Ukraine, the Ukraine's military forces and ability to fight. But it's still got a way to go, I think. And I think that the end game, it has to be a maneuver into a situation where basically they accept an unconditional surrender. That's it. I don't think there's any room for negotiation anymore. And that's also been said more or less explicitly by, you know, different Russian ministers. So, you know, this could roll into early next year. And I think that the U.S. administration was just trying to keep the show on the road, at least until November, to get the election out of the way. Otherwise, if you spend the odd $100 billion on this war and it blows up in your face before the election, then that's going to look pretty bad. In the aftermath, you know, if Trump wins, in principle, he's less opposed to Russia and the and financing the war. But, you know, they're still going to have concerns about what it means for U.S. power. So we'll probably find, if Trump did win, we'll probably find more of a shift in the direction of being anti-China rather than being anti-Russia, and saying this is all a big mess and it's all caused by the Biden regime. If Kamala Harris wins, you know, against the odds, I would say, but if she does win, then in principle, things kind of roll on a bit the same, but they still can't win against Russia. So what they will do is maybe more provocations, this issue of long-range missiles and everything, and then that brings us several more steps closer towards World War III, because Russia recently revised its nuclear doctrine, which has actually been pretty clear. It was only if there was an existential threat against the Russian state would they use nuclear weapons. And now they've slightly revised it. So it still comes down to this existential threat, but it doesn't mean they have to be attacked with nuclear weapons. And also they've included Belarus in the doctrine. So if there's a huge incursion in or invasion of Belarus, or if there's some big attack on Russia that starts trying to take out radars and missile silos, then they will consider that to be an existential threat. So, yeah, basically, yeah, the things are set up that Ukraine is definitely losing, although it's a slow process. And Russia is kind of giving a warning that if they try and pull various tricks ahead of it to threaten Russia, you know, it can easily get beyond a certain level where, you know, the issue of nuclear weapons comes out. And, you know, you've had Russian spokesmen sort of talking about it. I think Medvedev, you know, recently said it would just take, you know, one of our small missiles to, you know, turn somewhere like Latvia into just a wet heap on the coast of the Baltic, you know. So, yeah, I mean, he's done a lot of this kind of rhetoric, but indicating that that they're not going to give up. But as it stands now, it's a bit too embarrassing for NATO to give up either. So they're continuing with the military exercises around the Baltics, around the, you know, the western borders of Russia. And, you know, even in the Black Sea, they're building up Romanian military bases. Not entirely clear what they're going to be doing, but they might do some stuff in the Black Sea. You know, who knows? So, yeah, the Ukraine war is far from over because it's not about Ukraine. It's about NATO and the US versus Russia, meaning any challenge to the system. So we're going to find different versions of this for, you know, involving different countries over the coming years. But I would like to think that the Ukraine dimension of it would be sorted out, you know, within the next year, hopefully, you know, and hopefully even by early next year.
And right now, everybody is asking, everybody's so confused about what's going on in the European Union in terms of the policies in the United Kingdom. Mm-hmm. And when you put United Kingdom together with Germany, France, and you see that the United Kingdom's policy is totally the animosity in this policy toward Russia is so bold. And during the latest visit of Starmer to Washington, in which he was talking about the sending of long-range missiles to Ukraine, which was at the end it was rejected by Pentagon, but can we understand the behavior of the United Kingdom right now? And are they trying to play a little brother who's much in line with the core in the United States than the Biden administration?
I think this the issue for the UK is that they're in a really weak position, right? So they screwed up their, you know, kind of inter-country relationships with Brexit. So then they're left with only the US side, really. And the, you know, any big initiative that they've made has been to try and join the Trans-Pacific Partnership and things like this, you know. So it's become more US dependent because of the Brexit mess up. You know, I'm not saying I love the European Union, but that was clearly a political stupidity to completely ruin your relationship with, you know, your major trading partners, basically. And what this means is that also economically, you know, the UK is in a bit of a mess, you know, big deficits and stagnant growth and inflation is still too high, this kind of thing. So all they're left with is just making a noise and, you know, showing rhetorical leadership, you know, that's what it is, you know. So they can then come back and say, well, you know, Ukraine would have been in a stronger position had they done what we said, or something along those lines. It's completely pathetic, you know, and the UK doesn't really have much of a military. You know, its ships crash into each other and don't work properly. Its missiles, you know, not much to write home about either, and its army is pretty puny. What they're good at is some, you know, high-tech specialist items of military equipment, you know, nano drones and storm shadows and things like this, but nothing actually to promote a war, you know, actually get involved in a war. And that's why even on the Libya invasion, you know, some years ago now, they had to try and persuade the US to get involved, you know. So Britain and France couldn't do it on their own, and they had to get the US involved, even though it's a British-French gambit to invade Libya. And the UK on its own couldn't really do much either. So they always act as the best pal coming along helping the US rather than they could do that much independently. So they're making these noises, but it's a fear that they have that the world is slipping away from them. Because the world is slipping away from them. They're having less and less influence. And what would wreck actually both the UK and the EU, and that's why you have von der Leyen and people coming out with all this garbage too, what would wreck their status is if Russia wins in Ukraine, and it seemed that, you know, you can challenge the Western order and not be smashed to pieces, basically. And they're already, you know, concerned about China as well. You know, China has done nothing militarily, but, you know, they want to have like huge tariffs on Chinese electric vehicles and all kinds of other things, you know. So they're finding their economic and political situation being seriously squeezed. And they're panicking arguably even more than the US, because the US has always got other options. You know, it can go and cause trouble somewhere else, you know, and change the subject to some other thing it wants to get involved in. You know, maybe it's going to be Latin America, or maybe somewhere in Asia, you know. But they don't necessarily need to focus only on Ukraine and things around this region. So they can, and Trump in particular is, you know, one who wants to get the Europeans to pay more for military, you know. So I think the reason we find the more outrageous statements coming from the UK and Europe, maybe the UK in the worst position here, is that they see the structure that has kept up their privileges in the world being challenged and falling apart a bit. And they think, you know, God, what can we do? We have to keep this going. And so they want to keep the old structures in place, you know, keep, you know, our way of life, you know, in the same thing. So that's it. That's the political economic psychology behind the rubbish that we see coming out from them, even if they have no power actually to implement any of this stuff.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Tony, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
All right. Thanks. Bye now.
Thanks.